Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Dr. Gabriel Pauli. Gabriel just completed his PhD at the University of Exeter in 2020, focusing on Palestine in travel, British travel literature. But more importantly, Gabriel is also the Dhaka Award-winning recipient of the Jerusalem Quarterly with the article Jerusalem Through Evangelical Eyes, 19th Century Western Encounters with Palestinian Christianity. Gabriel, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the first question, and which I never change, it's, Gabriel, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
I just completed my PhD, I'd like to say, first of all, in Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, supervised by Professor Ilan Pape, who I'm sure many of your listeners will know of. I did look at Jerusalem a great deal in my work, but of course I have been lucky enough to visit Jerusalem several times. It's obviously a wonderful city. It's a place of great suffering and tragedy in recent years, as well as a very rich history. And an endlessly fascinating subject for our research.
Let me start with your award-winning article, because I found it fascinating that you're talking about the representation of Jerusalem. So in other words, you're not necessarily talking about the real city, but how the city was imagined by others. And in this case, the others are evangelicals in the 19th century. How did they see Jerusalem? What did they want to see? And what did they didn't want to see in the city?
Yeah, well, of course, I think I'd like to start off by giving a little bit of background. Jerusalem and Palestine, the Holy Land, in general, has been a site of pilgrimage, of visitation for centuries and millennia. And in fact, ever since the first kind of Christian pilgrims, of course, there's also a very rich Islamic and Jewish pilgrimage literature. But I've been focusing on specifically British Christians and to a lesser extent, American Christians, evangelical Protestants. But ever since the first kind of pilgrims, Christian pilgrims started going to Jerusalem in the kind of second and third centuries, they've been leaving their accounts of the city, and obviously they see the city through an outsider's eyes. And so we get a picture, as you say, we don't really get an accurate picture of the city itself and its social life and an experience of living in the city, but more the experience of someone who has come to Jerusalem for a specific purpose, with a particular ideology from a particular background, and the Jerusalem that they wanted to see. So to move things forward a little bit, my research looked at evangelical Protestants in the 19th century, mainly British, as I said, but also some Americans, some very important American travelers as well, who came to Palestine as part of a phenomenon called the Peaceful Crusade, which really ran from the kind of early to mid 19th century, maybe the 1830s, and the rule of Muhammad Ali and Ibrahim Pasha across Palestine and Greater Syria, until the First World War, when, you know, this travel ceased because of Britain's involvement against the Ottoman Empire. But between those kind of periods, there was a huge amount of travel, by and large, of evangelical Christians who wanted to see the Holy Land. They saw Palestine and Jerusalem through very Orientalist eyes. I'm sure I don't really need to explain that ideology to a great extent, but there was really a mismatch between the kind of values that they thought Jerusalem should represent in their Protestant interpretation of Christianity, of the Bible, of Christian ethics, and the actual living city that they found. And this is a literature of disappointment, of repulsion, and also a kind of colonial desire to possess and reshape, I would say.
You have a fascinating quote in your paper by Charles Biggs, who was an Anglican chaplain in Jerusalem in the late 19th century. He says, people often say they are disappointed in Jerusalem. They are disappointed not because Jerusalem is what it is, it's because it does not correspond with what they had trained themselves to expect, which I found fascinating. Like, people moved with some expectations to Jerusalem just to visit. And you mentioned that, but I was wondering if you have anything to add about it. I mean, what is that they really wanted to find? Was that spirituality, a building, a connection with God? When these British travelers, which I suppose were fairly wealthy because the tickets were expensive, they went to Palestine and particularly to Jerusalem, what is that they were really trying to find?
For a start, you're definitely correct to say that these were middle and upper class travelers. And very often, I would like to say, they also wrote down their experiences. That's why we have such a huge kind of body of evidence for their views, because it was very fashionable to not only go to Palestine, but also to write down your thoughts and your experiences, everything you saw, and publish that account. So there's a truly vast quantity of this literature, which is by and large very similar, I would say. It's the views expressed in it are within a kind of quite narrow range, although there are some outliers, which are also quite significant. I think your question about do they come to find spirituality, I would say no, because they did not see themselves so much as pilgrims. And there's an important line to be drawn between pilgrimage, which is a much stronger idea in other denominations like Catholic and Orthodox and many other denominations, which have all sent their pilgrims to Jerusalem over the centuries. And this kind of idea that evangelicals had of going to kind of witness and observe, and in a kind of mission to, I think, prove their interpretation of the scriptures against science, against Islam and atheism and kind of Enlightenment values, but they were very much trying to go to Palestine with a mission of proving their interpretation of the scriptures. As for what they kind of wanted to find, as you say, that quote from Biggs there, the kind of Jerusalem that they expected to find, was very much a mental image of the Jerusalem as it existed in the Old and New Testament times. I mean, not even necessarily as it existed, because we don't know many things about how it was at that time. It was their image that they had derived from other texts of previous travelers, sources such as Josephus, the first century Jewish historian of Jerusalem, the Bible itself, and popular prints and stained glass windows and hymns and kind of sermons, which were such a fundamental part of Protestant culture. They had an image of a very large city, a very well-built city, basically on Western lines, on Western grounds. And it was really not like the Palestinian city that they found, which has obviously been shaped by, deeply shaped by Islam, shaped by Orthodox and Catholic and other denominations of Christianity, and by the Jewish residents, who also didn't look like the kind of Jews that evangelicals wanted to find either in Palestine. So they found a city which was really, I mean, kind of like a normal Palestinian city, obviously with its specific features, but, you know, an Arab city under Ottoman Islamic control, where people were living their ordinary daily lives. And it was not this kind of New Testament era fantasy that they had and that they wanted to find and that they believed Jerusalem should be.
This idea of how Jerusalem should be, because it's still a valid principle for many in the 21st century, particularly now across the pond, where American Christian Zionists still have this idea of what Jerusalem should look like. And despite the fact they travel in large numbers, they sometimes avoid to visit certain parts of the city in order to keep that image, which I found troubling, but also fascinating at the same time, because this is about the process of exclusion of actually what Jerusalem is. I have one question. I really want to move to talk about how these evangelicals saw certain aspects of the city. But I think it's important for the listeners to understand who are these people and how they actually related with Christianity in general, and particularly with Christianity in Palestine. So what do they believe? I don't want to engage with you in a question about theology, but just to get a sense of what are their beliefs and particularly what is their relationship with local Christianity.
So I think I would just very briefly like to talk about the kind of theology and go back to the 17th century. I mean, obviously, these are the kind of early days of Protestantism, the 16th and 17th century, when Protestantism really founded. And then you have the Puritan period in the 17th century, when there was really a kind of, it's been called the Hebraic Revival. And that's a kind of obsession with the Old Testament in particular, the kind of morals and values of the Old Testament, and also an obsession with the Jewish people. Again, not as the Jewish people actually were, but ideas about the future of the Jewish people, whether they would be converted to Christianity, whether they would return en masse to Palestine and Jerusalem to create a new Palestine, which are obviously ideas that are still current among Christian Zionists, some evangelicals, particularly in America. But these ideas started in England with the Puritan kind of revolution in the 17th century, and then very much explode again in the 19th century with the evangelical movement. A great part of that was a kind of supremacist attitude and a quite exclusionary belief towards other denominations. This was all wrapped up with, rivalry. So there's rivalry with Catholic Europe, particularly France. There's the British imperial rivalry with Russia as well, which is obviously the kind of great Orthodox power in Europe. So Protestants were very particular about their own interpretation of Christianity, a very austere, kind of unaesthetic, I would say, plain, and they would characterize it as spiritual, and they would characterize anything else, like statues or icons or pilgrimage practices, as being non-spiritual, as being something kind of bodily, and they would call it corrupt, corrupted Christianity. They would see their own brand of Christianity as the only true form of Christianity that was acceptable. And some of these travelers who I looked at were quite open in saying that Orthodox, Catholic, Armenian, Ethiopian, they're not real Christians. They are, they're guilty of heathenism, just as much as, any other non-Christian group. So they were very extreme in their interpretation of the religion. They came with a kind of colonial mindset, I would say, of their own supremacy, and their own a missionary mindset as well. Very, very particular in the way that they approached Christianity.
I'm fascinated by the ways in which evangelicals look at other denominations, and in particular how that translates also in actions and obviously writing and criticism. There's this famous example of the Holy Fire, where it's a Greek Orthodox tradition where, for those of us that have been witnessing that or certainly aware of that, is some sort of a magic tradition, religion, but also compelling and I would say emotional, where you have thousands of people on Easter Sunday getting closer to the Holy Sepulchre, and all of a sudden, you have this fire coming out of the site where allegedly Jesus was deposed after his death and resurrected. And, you have the spreading of the fire. As I said, I understand a lot of people have different views and opinions, but it's certainly very moving. But the evangelicals, on the other hand, have a very different view about it, and they don't like it. Can you tell us about how they reacted to all of the local customs, particularly the Holy Fire?
I would see such ceremonies as, the Holy Fire is for sure the most significant, but there are others, and also Christian sites in Bethlehem, in Nazareth, in many other places around Palestine, which are of great importance to indigenous Palestinian Christians, and also to non-Protestant pilgrims, particularly in the 19th and early 20th, until the Russian Revolution stopped it. But there were huge amounts of Russian Orthodox pilgrims who would come. And in fact, I think of all the bodies of travelers to Palestine in the 19th century, the largest was these Russian Orthodox pilgrims. They came in huge numbers, and they were often viewed by these the travelers, Protestant travelers, as like their kind of polar opposite, everything they measured themselves against, everything they weren't, with this kind of the pilgrimage paradigm, as opposed to this kind of pseudo-scientific, pseudo-rational, actually kind of literalist, biblical interpretation that Protestants had. But yeah, of course, obviously, the indigenous Palestinians as well. These are greatly important ceremonies and part of their identity and rituals that have been carried out for many centuries. And as you say, it's a kind of miraculous, whether you believe in the miracle or not, I would say is irrelevant, because it's the importance it has as an identity for local Christians in the land of Jesus's birth. And Protestant travelers would often be in Jerusalem at the time. Springtime was the most popular time for travel. It was seen as having the best weather and the landscape was at its best at that time. So they would often be in Palestine at that time, be in Jerusalem at that time. They would very frequently go to the Holy Sepulchre, the church, to watch the ceremonies, but they would not engage. They would go to often the upper galleries of the church where you can look down on the ceremony from above. And they would kind of sit there making their critical notes. I think probably the most famous representation of this is the painting by William Holman Hunt of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at Easter time, the Pre-Raphaelite painter who went to Palestine many times, even built himself a house in Jerusalem. And this painting just depicts total chaos, total anarchy. There is no recognition of the spiritual values or the importance of the ceremony for those who are participating in it. It's just seen as a totally anarchic oriental, I would say, to use the word that they themselves would have used, event. And they would have measured that against the Protestant church service, which was carried out in particularly in Christchurch, Jerusalem, which is the first Protestant church in Jerusalem, and in fact in the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean, which was established under Muhammad Ali's rule first and then finally finished in the late 1840s, the building of it. And again, it would be a very austere, simple, plain service, as opposed to the quite elaborate and colourful and joyful rituals of Easter in the amongst the Orthodox, the Catholic, and all the other denominations. But yeah, Protestants absolutely looked down on that. And the written descriptions of the ceremony are quite, they're quite stunning in the way they compare it to, you know, pagan festivals, fire worship, riots. Everything you can imagine in these texts, with no hint of the spiritual values of the event.
Which leads me to ask you a question. You really use a very strong expression here, saying that evangelicals did not recognize the spiritual value of essentially the Greek Orthodox, but we can say also of the Catholics, of the Ethiopians, all of the more traditional Christian denominations. What about the people? How did they relate to local Palestinians, whether Jerusalemites or even, you know, in the villages, Bethlehem, Nazareth, and so forth? Mm.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Wow, that's, I mean, I would say that there were definitely a range of reactions and opinions. I mean, I think the first point is to say that travelers really gained very little insight into people's lives. Most travelers would turn up in Jerusalem. They might stay in, towards the later 19th century, there were hotels in Jerusalem, so that, you know, they might stay in a hotel. Earlier on in the century, they might stay with missionaries in missionary houses. They would often prefer to stay in the Muslim quarter, actually. And some missionaries had houses in the Muslim quarter rather than in the Christian quarters. And there's a kind of sense that they were more drawn to Muslim residents of Jerusalem and Palestine in general, rather than Christians. But yeah, they would gain very little insight into most people's lives. They would travel through the landscape, stopping an hour or two at a village. And often the people of the villages were very hospitable and welcoming. And there's many accounts of Palestinians sharing their food and water or even offering travelers to stay in their own homes, you know, quite touching details. But most of the travelers came with a very orientalist mindset, and they didn't really recognize their humanity in people, let alone Christianity amongst Christians. They didn't recognize a full humanity in the Palestinians that they encountered of any faith. Towards Christians in particular, there was a kind of aversion quite often, which is quite surprising because you wouldn't normally expect that. I mean, particularly from the way Said frames the question in Orientalism, which is, of course, a wonderful book and the kind of theoretical basis for much of what I've written, in that Orientalism is mainly about Islam and this kind of clash between an Enlightenment West and the Islamic world. But very often it was with the Eastern Christianity that travelers in Palestine clashed. I think because they still viewed and imagined Palestine as the Christian Holy Land. And that's what they wanted it to be. And when they found that Christianity itself in the Holy Land, indigenous Christianity, was so far from the kind of beliefs that they themselves had, it was shocking and disturbing for them.
We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show.
I want to ask you something about the legacy of this way of thinking, because I had the impression that eventually Christian Palestinians, but also Palestinian Christianity, regardless of a denomination, somehow has suffered throughout the last century or so because of this kind of vision. I mean, I noticed that essentially Palestinian Christianity has changed and has become also very defensive in a way. And so I was wondering your view about the long-term legacy of this evangelical thinking over Palestinian Christians, but also in general about, you know, so to Christianity in Palestine.
Yeah, I think it definitely carries over into the British Mandate period and then subsequently, because Towards the end of the 19th century, some travellers, I mean, British travellers, they really expected that Britain would eventually occupy Palestine. You know, even decades before 1917 and all the First World War and all of that and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, it was expected amongst travellers that, you know, Palestine would one day fall under British control. And also that Britain would help what they called the Jewish restoration, what they saw as the return of the Jewish people to Palestine. So these were ideas that were very extremely common throughout the 19th century. But towards the end of the Ottoman rule, there was a kind of awareness of the particularly the education systems and the fact that Palestinian Christians at that time were beginning to form a kind of intelligentsia class in Palestine. And obviously there were Muslims who were also part of that class. But particularly through the education in schools that were under French control or under Russian control, and of these rival powers and these rival churches to the Anglican Church, that Palestinian Christians were becoming to become quite powerful as a community, I think, and the potential to form a quite powerful community, which is what happened during the Mandate period, and many prominent nationalist leaders, and even subsequently, particularly on the political left in Palestine, some of the most prominent figures have been Palestinian Christians, you know, partly as a result of this legacy of education and a kind of slightly privileged position that Palestinian Christians had to begin with. So there was this aversion, a suspicion of Christians from the British authorities, and they didn't give Palestinian Christians representation in the way that they gave the Muslim community during the Mandate period. So I really think that Palestinian Christians didn't really fit in their conception of what Palestine was, because they didn't recognize that form of Christianity. They viewed Arabs and Muslims as synonymous, and counterposed those against the Jews who were to form the kind of European educated and ruling sector of society under that Zionist outlook that those officials had, and Christians didn't really fit in that into that that mind frame. So during the 19th century, there was a creeping suspicion of Palestinian Christians that really expanded during the Mandate period, I would say.
I want to ask you something about your general work and contextualizing with the work of others, Eitan Bar-Yosef, Lorenzo Kamel, tangentially also Issam Nassar about photography. All of your works focus on this idea of British representation of Palestine and of Jerusalem. The two are together, but also I noticed that there are people working specifically on Palestine, but also evangelicals who are mainly focusing on the city of Jerusalem, the site of where Jesus lived and died, and obviously, you know, making it the very focus of their work and attention. Why Britain? I mean, I know France, I know Germany, Spain, and to an extent other countries had an interest in the Holy Land, had an interest in Jerusalem, but why Britain? Why Britain became so attached to the Holy Land?
I think it goes back to, as I mentioned earlier, with that the kind of Protestant, the element in it of that kind of Hebraic obsession with the Jewish people, obsession with biblical prophecy, which did not exist in the same way amongst the denominations of other powers. I mean, for example, with the kind of system of consular protection that existed in Palestine in the 19th century, France assumed control over Catholic Christians, Russia assumed control over Orthodox Christians. There was not a Protestant community that Britain could, an extremely small one made up of a few converts, which, you know, amounted to kind of a few hundred people rather than a sizable community. So they really kind of devoted their efforts to the Jewish population in Palestine. That gave them a standpoint and a kind of belief about the future of Palestine and what Britain's role would be when that forecasted occupation actually occurred, which put it aside from the other powers. Of course, there was an imperial struggle over Palestine and a belief amongst all the powers that they would carve up the Eastern Mediterranean region, as happened in the Sykes-Picot Agreement eventually. But it was Britain's belief about the Jewish restoration and the fact that it would be Protestant Britain that would lead the Jews to Palestine that put it at the forefront. And I think for the same reasons, really, we've seen American evangelicals far, far overtake Britain in this kind of ideology. And we associate these views with evangelicals in America because those are the very same ideas that were imported through the settler colonization of America back in the 17th century. It really comes from the British source. And I discuss in the paper as well, Edward Robinson, who is a very, very important figure for attracting Protestant attentions to Palestine after he visited for the first time in 1838. So it was Americans and British, but British travellers certainly led the way in this idea about Palestine's colonization.
And I really want to ask you a chicken and egg question, in a sense that obviously Britain then became the colonial power who ruled Palestine and obviously making Jerusalem, together with Haifa, basically the economic and the political and also some sort of a moral center of British rule of Palestine. So the chicken and egg question is that, was it first religion, which then translated into a colonial project, or colonial projects were there before and eventually religion built up on that?
I would say that there was definitely a change. There was a shift from one to the other. I think in the first roughly, let's say, four decades, of the 19th century, there was this belief in the return of the Jewish people to Palestine and their conversion to Christianity. And this was undertaken in Jerusalem by a missionary organization called the London Jewish Society, which existed to attempt to convert the Jewish people to Protestantism, which was based in London and was part of the Anglican Church. When it became clear that was never going to happen, there were only a handful of Jewish converts to Christianity, it changed it became more about the colonization efforts. And by the later 19th century, there's figures such as one very important figure who I look at in my work is Lawrence Oliphant, who is well known as a proto-Zionist figure. And in the 1880s, devised a colonization scheme. And he actually originally located that in present-day Jordan, on the east of the Jordan River, because he recognized initially that Palestine was quite densely populated and there would not be an area where you could have a large-scale Jewish agricultural activity, because of the Palestinian Fellahin owned the land and already farmed the land in Palestine. But when he devised that plan, he was quite careful to say, this is not about religion. This is about use of the land. This is about about securing Palestine against Russian ambitions by having a kind of large population who would be friendly to Britain, supportive of British rule. And so kind of by the last few decades of the 19th century, the religious aspect is replaced by other aspects that are more to do with settler colonialism in its other forms. The justifications for settler colonization in America, in Australia, in Canada, also begin to be applied to Palestine in a way that wasn't solely dependent on the religious issue. But that became attractive for evangelicals because it harmonized with the religious ideas. So that they always remained in the background.
I have a time for a couple more questions. And one, it's kind of like a spin-off of what you were just talking about, thinking about current events. When we look at Palestine, Jerusalem in particular, and we see settler colonialism working, but this time led by, say, Israeli or Jewish communities. I mean, it's always complicated here to use the terms, but certainly there are forms of Israeli settler colonialism. And I was wondering to what extent, and if any, there was an influence from these ideas of evangelical settler colonialism moving into sort of first Zionism and Zionist ideology, which then translated into sort of Israeli settler colonialism.
I mean, for sure. And it's actually possible to identify the influence because some of these travelers, like Lawrence Oliphant, Claude Rainier Conda from the Palestine Exploration Fund, they ended up by giving quite concrete support to the early Zionists in the 19th century and in the late 19th century, by giving speeches, by fundraising. When Oliphant lived in Palestine, he lived in Haifa and in a village nearby called Daliat al-Karmal. And he gave, quite concrete support to the Zionist settlers who actually began arriving soon after he went to Palestine for the first time. So there's definitely a concrete link between those early Zionists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and the British travellers. More broadly, I mean, I'm often very struck by reading the accounts of these travellers and seeing to what extent they have been fulfilled. For example, again, Oliphant said, the areas he recommended for settler colonization in particular were the Golan Heights and the Jordan Valley. Both of these areas coming under control of Israel after 1967. And there's a street named after Oliphant in one of the settlements in the Golan Heights. So the Israeli government, they have repaid the kind of debt that they had to some of these travelers. In another sense, I always see what's happening now as the fruit of what's gone before. And Zionism as an ideology is never something that's been uniformly supported by the Jewish people, of course. And there's always been a huge amount of debate within the Jewish community. Back in the 19th and the early 20th century, there was a huge debate and many Jews opposing Zionism then, as they still do now. So it's important to recognize that this ideology is not a Jewish creation, not solely a Jewish creation. It was also greatly influenced by these individuals from the heart of empire, the British Empire. What the situation we see today is the fruit of their work. I strongly believe that.
I have one last question, and it's very much about your future work. So you are currently working on a monograph which will be published by IB Tauris in 2022, Palestine in the Victorian Age. Can you tell us what we are going to read, hopefully next year?
Yes, I would love to. So it's if people are able to read my article in Jerusalem Quarterly, then they'll find, and they enjoy it, they'll find much to enjoy in my book, I hope. And a lot of what we've been talking about will feature in there. But there's also some, you know, some further details. I do some more research about a farm in Jerusalem called Kerem Avraham, which was established by the consul, the British consul, James Finn. It's a neighborhood in West Jerusalem now called Kerem Avraham, but it was originally a settler colonial farm for Jews established by the British consul. I look at the Samaritan community in Nablus and how travelers related to them, and just many more issues from this period. And I've tried to pick some topics which are just unknown and issues that I've never read about in research, and kind of things that I stumbled across. Also from looking through old newspapers and journals and all sorts of source material, as well as these travel books, there's this huge, relatively untapped font of Orientalist writing on Palestine. And as I say, most of it is quite similar, and you obviously have to be very careful of it. You can't use it as a primary source material for understanding Palestine's social history at the time. But it does give a fascinating window into the relationships between the West and Palestine, the Palestinian people at this time. So please read my article if you can, and if you enjoy it, then my book will hopefully be satisfying.
This was Gabriel Poli, recently graduating from the University of Exeter with a PhD under the supervision of Ilan Pape, and more importantly, the award winner of a DACA award-winning essay by the Jerusalem Quarterly with an article, Jerusalem Through Evangelical Eyes, 19th century Western encounters with Palestinian Christianity. And as we just heard, working on a monograph, which we'll all enjoy next year. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.